Taylor, Rayshard Brooks, and many, many more. And so there are lots of people in prison based on that. So as we're having these uprisings out here, and we follow what happened in history with you know, the uprising in the 60s or civil rights movement, George Jackson was a revolutionary that, that you know, we can, it's hard to describe in a few seconds, but the incident took place in the very adjustment center now we're using to house people. I'm sorry. Yes.
We're going to have to leave it there. Adnan Khan, I want to thank you for being with us, Executive Director of Restore Justice, recently released from San Quentin. And that does it for our broadcast. A very happy birthday to Karen Ranucci. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks so much for joining us, and stay safe.
Listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming online at kboo.fm.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Spectrum, an outside-the-frame film festival on Saturday, June 27th from 2 to 4 p.m., streaming online. Spectrum will debut work that outside-the-frame participants have made in the last year. The film festival will focus on showcasing the unheard stories from the youth's perspective and allow the films to share creative expression and experiences. It will feature films, table readings, live music, a Q&A with the filmmakers, and more. Again, that's Spectrum, an outside-the-frame film festival on Saturday, June 27th from 2 to 4 p.m., streaming online. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Max killer Jeremy Christian is sentenced to life imprisonment. The Oregon State Legislature convenes for a special legislative session. And in national news, three men have been indicted in the killing of Ahmaud Arbery. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, June 24th, 2020. I'm Althea Billings. Max killer Jeremy Christian will spend the rest of his life in jail. Christian will serve life imprisonment without the possibility of parole for fatally stabbing Ricky Best and Talisa Namkaimeche, as well as for wounding Micah Fletcher aboard a Max train in 2017. Christian was found guilty of the 12 charges against him in February, including the Oregon version of a hate crime charge. Sentencing Judge Cheryl Albrecht denied Christian future parole because of her belief that he, quote, cannot be rehabilitated. Christian received two life sentences, one for each person he murdered, along with additional sentences for the 10 other charges. Those include the assault of Demetria Hester and threatening Sean Ford with a knife. Ford called Christian's actions on the Max train, quote, white terrorism. Fletcher, who was stabbed on the train, said it is, quote, abundantly clear that somebody must have failed miserably when it comes down to raising you. This has to stop eventually. Yesterday, during testimony from one of his assault survivors, Demetria Hester, Christian erupted into a violent rant and had to be removed from the courtroom. In his own statement, Christian described himself as a nihilist and did not take responsibility for those he had killed. The Oregon legislature began its special session today. When Governor Kate Brown called the legislature into session, she made it clear they should focus on police oversight. The previous legislative session was derailed after Republican lawmakers staged a boycott to block a bill set to reduce Oregon's greenhouse gas emissions on March 5th. In this session, six police accountability measures raised by the legislature's nine-member People of Color Caucus will be brought before the legislature. The legislature will be voting on motions that include banning police chokeholds and mandating rent protections during the COVID-19 pandemic. Other proposals for law enforcement include creating a statewide online database of discipline records for police officers, banning the use of tear gas on protesters, and allowing the state attorney general to investigate and prosecute officers who kill or seriously injure someone. Logistically, state lawmakers will be expected to attend in person. They are encouraged to wear masks, but so far there's no rule requiring them to do that. Lawmakers will be allowed to watch proceedings remotely, but will only be able to vote in person. The public will be banned from entering the Capitol and will have to testify remotely. Starting today, in seven Oregon counties, when you enter an indoor public space, you have to wear a face covering. Those seven counties are Multnomah, Washington, Clackamas, Salem, Polk, Lincoln, and Hood River. People under 12 years of age and those with a disability or medical condition that prevents them from covering their face are not required to do so. Lincoln County will not require people of color to wear masks to prevent racial profiling and possible harassment. It's one of the first counties in the U.S. to make this exemption. Renika Moore of the ACLU's racial justice program told CNN it's a, quote, lose-lose scenario because either way, Black Americans feel endangered. The American Public Media Research Lab estimates that Black Americans' COVID-19 mortality rate is 2 times higher than that of white and Asian Americans. On July 1st, the European Union will be allowing international travelers to enter for the first time since mid-March. However, travelers from countries with high and rising rates of coronavirus infection, like the U.S., Russia, and Brazil, will still be banned. A final list of banned countries, also expected to include China and other nations like Uganda, Cuba, and Vietnam, is expected early next week. Most EU countries have curbed the spread of the virus and emerged from lockdown, while new cases continue to grow in the US, India, and many other nations around the world. Meanwhile, in the US, New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut will require travelers from certain other states to quarantine for 14 days upon arrival. The list of states currently rests at 9, but it includes Texas, Florida, the Carolinas, Utah, and Washington. The U.S. has reported more than 2.3 million cases and experienced more than 120,000 deaths from the virus. Advocates are pleading for help from the federal government as health centers across the state of California close in the wake of the COVID-19 pandemic. Suzanne Potter from the Public News Service has more on that story.
About 200 health centers across the state have closed their doors during the pandemic because the number of patient visits dropped by half, leading advocates to push for more federal relief. They do get some CARES Act funding, but the Paycheck Protection Act specifically excluded clinics with more than 500 employees. Carmela Castellano-Garcia with the California Primary Care Association says 22 of the state's largest clinics are really hurting financially.
We are swept up in the funding allocations that are not specific to health center needs, and so therefore our needs have not been addressed. So that is why we will continue to push for health center specific funding.
The latest tranche of federal funding allocated dollars for safety net hospitals but excluded health centers, so advocates are asking the Department of Health and Human Services to carve out a specific fund for the centers. Castellano-Garcia says the state's community health centers provide health care to millions of low-income Medi-Cal patients, a population that is only going to grow as job losses mount.
There are 1,300 sites serving 7.2 million people. We are seeing 1 in 3 of the state's Medi-Cal recipients and 1 in 6 Californians.
Many health centers are hanging on by offering more visits over the telephone to reduce the spread of COVID-19. Currently, 50% of visits are done over the phone, a trend that may persist after the pandemic subsides. For Public News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
A grand jury indicted 3 men for the murder of Ahmaud Arbery back in February. They face charges of malice and federal murder. Arbery was killed when Gregory and Travis McMichael armed themselves, jumped in the back of their truck, and pursued 25-year-old Arbery, who was jogging through their neighborhood. Gregory McMichael told authorities he believed Arbery was a burglary suspect and said that Arbery had attacked his son. A third man, William Bryan, saw the McMichaels driving by and joined in the chase. Cell phone footage captured by Bryan shows the McMichaels confronting Arbery before Travis gets physical with him. Moments later, multiple gunshots are heard and Arbery is seen stumbling on the road and falling. Bryan told investigators he heard Travis use a racial epithet after fatally shooting Arbery. On Tuesday, the Georgia legislature passed a hate crime bill meant to extend sentences for people convicted of targeting others based on race, sexual orientation, gender, and some other factors. The three men have been indicted on 9 counts each, including criminal attempt to commit false imprisonment. The men remain in jail without bond. An extended freeze on green cards and work visas will impact over 500,000 people. President Donald Trump extended the pause on some green cards and suspended visas like the H-1B visa for foreign workers until the end of 2020. This freeze appears to disproportionately impact visa seekers from India. Last year, nearly 3/4 of the H-1B visa for foreign workers were granted to people from India. The White House says the move will create jobs for Americans struggling due to the pandemic. Critics of the move say the measures will actually hurt the economy. The visa suspension also restricts H-4 visas that allow foreign family members to enter the country. At the same time, the Citizenship and Immigration Agency is preparing to furlough a majority of its staff. This move will likely end up worsening the immigration backlog. The agency normally depends on fees from new immigration applications, but is now in danger without them, asking for a congressional bailout of over $1 billion to avoid cutting its staff. The House Judiciary Committee heard testimony on Wednesday from 2 Department of Justice attorneys who said that improper political influence has disrupted multiple cases, including the sentencing recommendation for close Trump associate Roger Stone. Much of the testimony spoke to how federal prosecutors had been pressured to change recommendations based on political pressure from the administration. Republicans on the committee immediately derailed the proceedings by attempting to drown out the testimony using tactics that Chairperson Gerald Nadler had consistently allowed in the chamber. These tactics included rants against the Obama administration, citing baseless conspiracy theories, and banging on their desks. Representative Louie Gohmert of Texas attempted to drown out Donald Iyer's testimony by banging on his desk and justified his actions by saying, quote, "There's no rules about when you can make noise." The testimony of the witnesses detailed how Attorney General William Barr and President Trump have compromised the Justice Department. Aaron S.J. Zielinski, an assistant U.S. attorney for the District of Maryland, gave testimony regarding Roger Stone's sentencing recommendation. He said, quote, "When we refused to go along, we were instructed to disregard the guidelines entirely. When we again refused, we were told that we could be fired if we didn't go along. And while all this was happening, I was repeatedly told the department's actions were not based on the law or the facts, but rather on political considerations, Mr. Stone's political relationships, and that the acting U.S. attorney was afraid of the president." Stone was convicted on several charges in November of 2019 and sentenced to 40 months in prison. Yesterday's primaries and runoffs were flush with absentee ballots, but there were some issues with in-person voting, polling places that opened late in New York City and just one location per county in some parts of Kentucky. With more on the story, it's Lily Bulkey with 2020 Talks.
Welcome to 2020 Talks, where we track the 2020 elections in uncharted territory.
Much work remains to be done to really fine-tune the process to ensure that everyone is able to vote and vote successfully in advance of November.
Kristen Clark from the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law says yesterday's primaries in Kentucky, New York, and Virginia, and runoffs in North Carolina, South Carolina, and Mississippi bring crucial lessons for November. Clark commended Kentucky's expanded absentee voting, but noted a major problem, particularly in Jefferson County, where Louisville is. Some folks, especially seniors, had difficulty parking and accessing the county's only polling place, the Expo Center. She says that's unacceptable.
Certainly in a county that has a high poverty rate and a poor public transportation system, and people with disabilities and senior citizens, voters deserve options.
But at 1.2 million square feet, the center had ample space for voting stations 8 feet apart, allowing for short lines and proper social distancing. But voters were still in line as polls closed at 6 p.m. Circuit Judge Annie O'Connell ruled to keep them open until 6:30, but no later. In New York, some polling places open late, mostly in the city, but at least one upstate. Common Cause New York's Susan Lerner says that wasn't the only issue.
Whether it's incompetence, a mere mistake, or malintent, some poll workers have been failing to provide voters with the full ballot. This is absolutely unacceptable, and it cannot happen again in November.
All states saw huge demand for mail-in voting, though some voters never received their requested ballots and had to vote in person or not at all. Yesterday, the University of Michigan withdrew from hosting the October presidential debate. Professor Mitchell McKinney from University of Missouri, whose expertise is in debates, is surprised by the alternate location, Miami, Florida.
I was surprised when I saw that Michigan pulled out, that they then went to their alternative site, which is in Florida, of all places, you know, right now, a COVID hotspot, it seems like.
The move comes as President Trump seeks to increase the number of debates to four, start earlier than September, and have more control over who the moderators are. But former Vice President Joe Biden committed yesterday to the Presidential Debate Commission's current plan, three debates this fall. Edward Lee is the director of Emory University's debate program.
If you go back to December, you will find a litany of news articles and even some video of President Trump saying that he had some hesitancy around the question of whether or not he should even enter into these debates during this electoral cycle.
What's changed, according to Lee?
I think that what you're seeing now is that at that point in time that he was in a more fortuitous place in the polls and where he was electorally than he is now.
Yesterday, Twitter put another warning label on one of Trump's tweets for, quote, the presence of a threat of harm against an identifiable group. And former President Barack Obama returned to the campaign trail for a Biden fundraiser. From Pacifica Network and Public News Service, I'm Lily Bolke. Thanks for listening at pacificanetwork.org and publicnewsservice.org.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth report on Measure 57 concerning gerrymandering in Oregon. At 6, it's the Underground. Then at 7, tune in for Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's weather will be clear with a low of 59. Tomorrow, expect partly cloudy skies with a high of 86. Today in history, in 1986, singer, songwriter, producer, and actress Solange Knowles was born. The quote of the day is from Solange Knowles, who said, quote, "We are getting an education of a lifetime. We're actually out there in the real world." Molly of Denali, a TV show on PBS that represents indigenous people in Alaska, won a Peabody Award for excellence in broadcasting. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to indigenous news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The National Congress of American Indians hosted an online forum Tuesday with five tribal chairmen. As Emily Schwing reports, they all shared concerns about tribal lands and sacred spaces they believe are under attack by the federal government.
Cedric Cromwell is the chairman of the Mashpee Wampanoag tribe.
We're in a crisis within a crisis, if you will.
As Cromwell's tribe finds ways to respond to COVID-19, he says their assets have come under attack by the U.S. Department of Interior. He says he was notified by the Bureau of Indian Affairs back in May that the agency was looking at ways to reclaim land in Massachusetts that belongs to the tribe. And that story's familiar for Mark Fox, the chairman of the Mandan, Hidatsa, and Arikara Nation, who says land held in trust is invaluable to his people.
We have been using these assets to rebuild our nation, reestablish our economy, build schools, work with our medical, insurance for all of our people, burial funds, helping our people with funerals, all these different things that we've done to help improve our nation with our trust asset. And yet there's a great danger of taking that away.
Chairmen from the Cheyenne River Sioux, the Tohono O'odham, and the San Carlos Apache tribes also spoke during the forum. They called for a restructuring of the Department of the Interior, an increased understanding of trust responsibility at the federal level, and a focus on tribal land-related issues within the first 100 days of the next U.S. presidential administration in 2021. For National Native News, I'm Emily Schwing. The PBS television show Molly of Denali was selected for a George Foster Peabody Award in the children's and youth category. KMBA's Trip Krause spoke with a producer about the significance of the win.
The animated series is set in the fictional Alaska village of Kaya. Its title character, Molly, and much of the cast represent indigenous people. And many people behind the show are also Alaska Native. Princess Desiree Johnson, who is Nitsaik Wachin, is a creative producer on the show. She says the win brings up a lot of emotions.
I'm kind of like at a loss for words because I did not grow up seeing myself represented in a positive light. And the fact that my kids get to see themselves like this, it means so much. It means a lot.
Molly of Denali is the first nationally distributed children's series to feature a lead character who's Native American. The 10-year-old Molly Mabray is Gwich'in Koyakon in Dena'ina Athabascan and is voiced by young actress Sovereign Bill, who's Muckleshoot in Tlingit. For Johnson, that representation matters.
It's just a mirror of who we are as Alaska Native people, all those powerful and good things. And those are the exact values that the world needs right now.
The George Foster Peabody Awards pay tribute to compelling and empowering stories in broadcast. A board of 19 jurors unanimously chose all the winners. Molly of Denali premiered in July 2019. I'm Tripp Krause.
The Sac and Fox Nation in Oklahoma closed its casinos this week after an employee tested positive for COVID-19. A statement from the tribe alerted the public about the closures, saying two casinos are temporarily shut down for cleaning as officials work on safety measures. No reopening date has been announced. Tribal casinos across the country have started to reopen after being closed for months due to COVID-19. The Gila River Indian community in Arizona recently closed its gaming operations again after the death of an employee due to complications of COVID-19. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
In the Bay Area, the Society of Fearless Grandmothers is standing up for young activists. With more on the story, here's Dr. Anthony Lizowitz with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. Young climate activists have attracted national attention, but in the San Francisco Bay Area, a group of older women sometimes joins them on the front lines. They call themselves the Society of Fearless Grandmothers, and founder Penny Opal Plant says their job is to make sure that young people stay safe.
Older women have a special role in these nonviolent direct actions and marches. We're not afraid to put ourselves between law enforcement and all of the younger people behind us.
For example, before the 2018 Global Climate Action Summit, the grandmas blocked streets while protesters painted a giant mural depicting a range of climate solutions.
And it is very effective because law enforcement are always a little bit surprised at seeing grandmothers blockading streets. And our police liaisons were all trained in how to talk to them in a good way, in an elder, respected, kind, loving way.
She says the women feel passionate about addressing climate change and creating a safer world for their grandchildren.
We have to do everything we can to protect future generations and the entire system of life.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To hear more stories like this, visit climateconnections.org.
KBOO News poet Dan Raphael knows what the president doesn't like.
Donnie don't like COVID. He can't call it names, threaten it, or cancel its visa. Neither the border wall or the one around the White House can stop it. Donnie don't like voters, because more of them will vote for anybody but him. So he and his stooges are blocking voters every way they can. Like yesterday in Lexington, Kentucky, 750,000 people, one polling place. Donnie don't like facts, so he says whatever serves him, maybe thinking if he repeats something often enough, people believe, but that doesn't work because he keeps changing his targets, his fake history, whether he's lying or doesn't care to know are both reasons for him to leave. Donnie don't like inspector generals, investigators, and judges, unless Mitch picked them. He doesn't like the planet. He doesn't like the future. He doesn't like the vast majority of the world's people. Donnie knows only his life matters. For Poetic Justice, this is Dan Raphael.
The Environmental Protection Agency plans to relax reporting requirements for companies releasing perfluorinated chemicals, or PFAS, into the environment. PFAS are what's called forever chemicals. Teflon is the best known one. PFAS are linked with many dangerous health conditions like cancer, low infant birth weight, immune issues, and thyroid disruptions. Under current rules, manufacturers should report to the government if they release 100 or more pounds of chemicals into a waterway per year. But in the proposed new rules, companies don't have to report if no single PFAS exceeds one cent per... But in the proposed new rules, companies don't have to report if no single PFAS exceeds 1% of the total release. The EPA is also skipping the usual step of allowing the public to comment before finalizing the rule. Eve Gartner, a managing attorney at Earth Justice, said, quote, "We know that PFAS at one teaspoon in an Olympic-sized swimming pool can have health effects. The new rules means PFAS are likely to contaminate more drinking water, as well as lead to more preventable health issues for people across the nation." Former National Security Advisor Michael Flynn will not face charges for perjury and lying to the FBI after an appeals court ordered his criminal proceedings dropped. This ruling responds to the Department of Justice's unorthodox request to drop the case altogether. The decision was written by Judge Naomi Rao. Judge Rao was appointed in 2019 by President Trump after working in the White House. As a result of the ruling, Flynn won't get a criminal sentence, even though he had already pled guilty to lying to investigators. The decision received considerable criticism for granting the unprecedented request to drop the case earlier this year. Trump immediately expressed his pleasure about the decision on Twitter, calling it, quote, great. Flynn was an early target in the Russia investigation led by Special Counsel Robert Mueller, who later said Flynn cooperated after pleading guilty. More recently, Flynn argues he was pressured into his guilty plea. Most people don't know that the full name of America's smallest state is the State of Rhode Island and Providence Plantations. Governor Gina Raimondo signed an executive order yesterday shortening that title to just Rhode Island. In a statement, she wrote, quote, "The pain that the word plantations causes to some of our residents should be a concern to all Rhode Islanders, and we should do everything in our power to ensure that all communities can take pride in our state." Although Rhode Island was the first colony to abolish slavery in 1652, the law was never enforced. Many people headed to Twitter to disparage the United States for not educating students about the real name of the state. One person tweeted that this, quote, "is exactly why African American history belongs on every school curriculum." The state Senate plans to introduce a referendum for residents to vote on the name change in November. A similar referendum in 2010 was opposed by more than 75% of the voters at that time. You are listening to the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, June 24th, 2020. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Dan Raphael and Nat Moon. The producer is Nat Moon, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Lily Bolke, Antonia Gonzalez, Anthony Lizowitz, and Suzanne Potter. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Althea Billings. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO at 8, it's KBOO Talk Radio. At 9, tune in for Press Watch, the news you're not supposed to know with Teresa Mitchell. At 10, it's Flashpoints, investigative news with Dennis Bernstein. Then at 11, it's Between the Covers, featuring interviews with locally and nationally known authors. At 11:30, we'll hear Words and Pictures, featuring an interview with radical educator Bill Ayers and comic artist Ryan Alexander Tanner. All of these KBOO programs, including the evening news, are made possible by support from our listeners. If you'd like to support our programming, go to kboo.fm or use our mobile app and click on Donate. Stay tuned now for KBOO News in Depth.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
We are joined now by Kate Titus with Common Cause to talk about a ballot measure that's being proposed for the November election. And this is a ballot measure about redistricting and about gerrymandering of districts in Oregon. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about what this measure is and what it will do if it passes.
Yeah, thanks for covering this story. I think it's really important. So, first, it's most basic. I think most people have a basic understanding of redistricting, but it's not something we think about as much as we probably should, given that it really gets at the heart of political power. So just to give context, I think most of us recall that every 10 years, the country conducts a census to get an updated count of the U.S. population. That's happening right now. Then once that's done, we redraw the maps for political districts, adjusting for shifts in the population so that there's an equal number of people in each district, giving every vote the same weight. So the way we shape those districts really has a big impact on who can get voted, what blocks of voters and what voter interests really can aggregate to have power, and it can be used really as a way for one party to gain leverage over another to fight their voter count, but it also can be used by incumbents to boost their own power, and it creates a way in which the districts become shaped around the interests of candidates and parties rather than the interests of voters. So it really is an issue that affects political power in this country, and is one that we as voters should really pay more attention to than we have. The problem in the past is that most states have been doing this through their legislatures. Legislators draw the lines, and there's an inherent conflict of interest. Districts end up reflecting someone's reelection strategy instead of our community's interests. So that's the issue that needs to change. Here in Oregon, actually most of the process has not only happened by the legislature, but really happens behind closed doors before they get in to the legislature. And so most of it has not even been in public sight, which is really problematic. But that's all starting to change, and some states are now using independent citizens commissions to draw the maps, and that structure is now considered best practice, and that's what we're trying to move here.
Well, when you talk about redistricting and the way that political parties shape those districts, how does race and racism play into that? Because I know in the conversations about gerrymandering, especially in the southern states, that's always a big issue.
Yeah, and race is a really good example of how the process is messed up. Because really what's happening now is the redistricting process is very much attuned to political party, and even there, only the two major political parties. So it's a struggle for power between a majority and a minority party, but the two biggest parties trying to maintain as much power and keep safe seats for their for districts that could be in play. But what we know that though many people, many of us as voters, do identify with one party or another, we're much more than our party affiliation. That's not the only thing that we think about. We also identify as part of a particular neighborhood or region, a racial group. We might also have interests that have to do with our school districts or, you know, even really the environmental watershed area that we're in. Depends on what concerns are up. And those are the things that don't get reflected. So you can easily have a racial demographic, that, you know, a group, a racial community that is a minority in a population, but a significant one that never can reach enough of a have enough power to gain political representation, and that's been the case very much in Oregon. During the last redistricting process 10 years ago, some organizations, including Common Cause and PECUN, the Farm Workers Union, really weighed in to the process and brought a lot of public comment into the process. And that helped in pushing the legislature to create the first minority-majority district in around Woodburn, where a couple minority groups together, Latino and Slavic, really together, because of the way the lines were drawn, now are a majority in one district. And for the first time, we're seeing Latino representatives of some of the elections in that area for positions.
One of the things that this measure calls for is a body that will set up the redistricting or recommend the redistricting that is politically neutral. What is that body going to be made up of, and how will it be politically neutral?
Yeah, to start with, I should say the process is politicized. Drawing district lines, you can't make it not politicized, but you can greatly diminish the politicization and the conflicts of interest, and we've seen that in places that have moved this reform. So the idea is not to take out perspectives of different parties, but to not let a partisan perspective rule the maps. So in this case, to neutralize the influence of political parties, the commission is formed with a balance of people who identify as either being from one of the two major political parties or a third party or no party at all. So in this case, we're talking about a 12-person commission with four Democrats, four Republicans, and four who are either third party or non-aligned. And the purpose of that is not to have those people represent by percentage the population in the state. It's to actually prevent a partisan representation in the final decisions. The rules of the decision-making also include that there has to be buy-in from at least one person on the committee from each of those party groups. So it forces people to cooperate and look beyond just how can they best represent the interests of their party. They bring an understanding of their own party perspective, but this is not about winning power for a political party through the redistricting cycle. We want to have the rules of the game fairly neutral, and then at the election, at the ballot box, that's where parties can vie for their power.
And so this is petition measure 57 that it's now attempting to get on the ballot in November. I know that several measures have been trying to get signatures in by the July deadline. What is the current status of this measure, and how close are you to getting the needed signatures, especially challenging, I guess, during this time of isolation because of COVID-19?
Yeah, we're now just 8 days out from the signature deadline to get on the November 2020 ballot. So this is really a make-or-break moment for Oregonians if we want to enact a fair and transparent process in time for this upcoming 2021 redistricting. We really just have a week left to pull this out. What I'm sure people realize, you know, this COVID pandemic threw a wrench into our lives, into everything, and that threw even our democracy. It had an impact on how we can run campaigns and ballot measure. In ordinary times, we would have signature gatherers out in the streets at places where there's a density of population. They'd be going door to door with the clipboard. That's really not considered safe right now. And so for this campaign, we had actually just gotten through all the legal hoops and qualified to start collecting signatures right at the time that the stay-at-home orders, the pandemic, really hit here. So it really put the whole thing on hold, and we've had to revamp our signature gathering program entirely. It's pretty exciting what we've been able to do, and I think it's a testament to Oregonians really stepping up in the face of challenge and saying we're not going to let this COVID pandemic stop our democracy. We're gonna make it happen anyway. So we've used alternative strategies. We've mailed to half a million households in Oregon, each of which had multiple registered voters at them. So really, nearly went out to really over a million Oregon voters. And we had a fantastic response from that. Tens of thousands of voters responded immediately. We've also had a massive online effort going on where organizations that are supporting this campaign, like Common Cause and other good government groups, the NAACP, the League of Women Voters, OSCRG, these groups are emailing out to their members and supporters, letting them know about this. And then Oregonians can actually online download the petition, print it out on their home computers if they have a home computer and a home printer, sign it and mail it back to the campaign with a stamp and envelope. So it's a little bit harder for folks to do than just having a quick conversation at the farmer's market or a supermarket with somebody learning about it and saying, sure, I'll sign. You really actually, you know, have to take the step to print it out, sign it, and mail it back. But we're getting thousands of them daily, and it's really just exciting to see this unique program working.
And if people are interested in signing this petition or in finding out more about IP57, which calls for an independent citizen-led redistricting commission for the state of Oregon, how could they find out the information or get copies of this petition?
Yeah, you can Google People Not Politicians Oregon. That's the easiest way to find us. The People Not Politicians campaign has a website right there. It's right up there, the information on how to sign the petition. You can also look through it and find lots of information about the reform and the campaign. So that's the easiest way. You can also, if you'd like to talk to someone, there's contact information on that site, People Not Politicians.
And I suppose there's probably not a way for people who don't have access to the internet to get this petition at this point.
Yes, it's. I think the probably the easiest thing. The Common Cause number 503-283-1922. Folks can give us a call, and we'll try to help every person individually.
Can you repeat that number?
It's 503-283-1922. 503-283-1922. That's Common Cause Oregon.
Great. So if people want to find out about IP57 or get copies of this petition, you can call that number, 503-283-1922, or go to the website peoplenotpoliticiansoregon.com. And again, Kate, what is the deadline?
Yeah, so we'd like to get signatures into our office by the end of the week. So it's really a quick turnaround. However, the actual deadline for us to get them into the state office is the 2nd. So if people are worried that they've missed the deadline, they should still call us up and we'll try to make this work.
Great. So if you have the petition, try and get it into Common Cause by this week. Again, we're talking with Kate Titus of Common Cause. And the coalition is People Not Politicians that is introduced IP57, Initiative Petition 57, for the November 2020 election to call for an independent commission to be the ones to determine the redistricting of Oregon's state and, I guess, federal districts as well, the voting areas that are all across the state. Right, and thank you so much, Kate Titus with Common Cause Oregon, for being with us today.
Thank you.
Bye. This is Jenka Soderberg with KBOO News.
And now it's time for News from the Boo, the weekly segment from people inside of and around KBOO with news from your community radio station.
Well, good evening. You are listening to News from the Boo here on your community radio station, KBOO Portland. My name is Jenna, and I am going to be your host for the next 15 minutes. I am also one of KBOO's interim station co-managers. Tonight, it's just me, and we're just going to do all the things that we do here on News from the Boo every week. We're going to talk about everything KBOO, everything inside, outside, about KBOO. This is a show.